6:45 on the Drive with Duff, and we are joined by Beryl Wiseman, Last Angry Man, here on the new 940. Takes over at 7 o'clock. So, Beryl, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
I got a question for you. What prompted Michael Ignatieff to go on Tout le monde en parle on Radio-Canada, Guy Lepage's Yap Fest, and say, I was a professor of human rights. I am also a professor of the laws of war and what happened in Canada in during the Israel-Lebanon war this summer was a war crime, and I should have said that. That's clear. What prompted Mr. Ignatieff to do that?
Well, I'll answer it two ways, from my perspective and from what I've been told by people in his campaign. From my perspective, it was, at best, you know, I can't even say it. There's no at best. From my perspective, it was pandering to a vote in Quebec and motivated by advisors, I think, who were whispering in his ear, the same kind of advisors like Denis Coderre, who led the Hezbollah rally and put the Federal Liberal Party's name to that egregious press release. Strict pandering.
Yes, in August.
In August. It wasn't just that Denis Coderre, who's his Quebec lieutenant, was in the march, but he affixed the name of the party to the press release, which specifically excluded any pro-Israel groups and specifically included a number of groups under CSIS investigation, the Marxist-Leninist Party of Quebec, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Straight pandering. What do people in his campaign say? And part of it you saw in the National Post today from Leslie Church. Well, he was trying to say that it was a tragedy of war. He didn't mean to use those words, but he's not retracting the word war crime. Well, you know, this is like a Jackie Mason tape. I didn't mean to say it. If I said it, I wasn't there. If I was there, I wouldn't have said it. This is an extraordinarily intelligent man, Jim.
That's why I can't figure out why it came out of his mouth.
This man's business is words. If you read The Lesser Evil, one of his latest books, he even makes a convincing case for torture, which Alan Dershowitz then picked up in another book. It boggles the imagination that an intellect like this would be used for petty, tawdry politics.
Okay, but now step back for a second. He said, when was it? In August, in a newspaper interview, he said he was not losing sleep over an Israeli bombing that killed dozens of civilians in Canada.
This is another aspect of the question about Ignatieff. He also has extraordinary access to intelligence sources. And even at the time that he said that I'm not going to lose any sleep because it's a war. It's not, he didn't talk about the loss of life. That's tragic. What he meant was that every investigation that was going into Khan at the time agreed on two things. Number one, that the Israeli bombing of Khan had stopped 8 hours before that building collapsed. And number two, that there weren't 68 people in that building. There were only 29, according to the Lebanese government. And number three, that none of the bodies had blood. No crushed skulls, severed limbs.
May have been prior dead, yes.
And not prior dead and brought there later. So, but you know, it begs another question. Michael Ignatieff is obviously not anti-Israel. He's not stupid. This was a politically exploitive statement. But you know what? You take a look at the other candidates. Jerry Kennedy's campaign. Boris Vibozhensky, the Toronto Liberal MP who's backing Kennedy, who went to the Middle East and said that Israel was using state terror. No discussion of the state terror or the war crimes of Lebanon allowing Hezbollah to throw rockets against hundreds and killing dozens.
He resigned. He resigned.
But look what's going through the Liberal Party. I'm getting to a point very quickly. Tom Hubert, BC member of Jerry Kennedy's campaign, vile anti-Semitic statements on his own website. He was asked to leave the campaign. Bob Ray has since the beginning of the Mideast war, even when Arab states were cheering Israel on to defeat Hezbollah, was talking about nuance and proportionality. And now Ignatieff. What you have in the Liberal Party is the use of Israel as a moral resort area and a moral failure of will to make common cause with a sister democracy that's the front line nation battling Islamic terror. And if they don't have that kind of will, how the hell are any of these guys going to lead the country? It's not all about transfer payments. It's not all about the environment, which has in any case been handled badly by liberal administrations. So if they don't have a clarity of vision, a candor of speech, and a courage of purpose. What the hell are they want to be leaders of?
Yeah, but you still haven't addressed my first question.
Which one?
Why did he do it?
I think he did it because, as I said at the beginning, Denis Coderre is his Quebec lieutenant.
No. Why? What vote does he hope to get?
Forget about the vote. I'm sorry, Jim. I wasn't catching the gist of your question. There is still a recount going on for delegates in Montreal North and Bourassa ridings. And many people don't know that. There is still a recount of contested ballots from the...
I thought we finished that last weekend.
Somebody in the party told me, and as a reporter told me, in banana republics they do this faster. Mexico recounted a national election faster. There is still a recount going on in certain ridings in Montreal North that are in Coderre's backyard. And that have a heavy Arab Muslim population. And...
Oh.
I don't know if that's a direct influence, but it's certainly you asked a question. There's another aspect of this.
Oh, it's the battle.
Wait, Jim,
back.
Jim.
I should
Chris,
have known.
Chris is making signals.
We're taking a break, and then when we come back, we want to talk about rearming. I'm talking about with nukes, Japan. This is the Drive with Duff on the new 940 with the last angry man, Beryl Wiseman. 6:54 on the Drive with Duff, and we're back with Beryl Wiseman. So, Beryl, I was reading David Frum today.
Yep.
He suggested a nuclear Japan is the thing that China and North Korea dread most, and he obviously buys into the same conspiracy theory that you and I believe in, and that is that China has certainly put North Korea and, to a lesser extent, Pakistan up to this. Well, equally. The one thing that they would fear would be a nuclear Japan. Not only would the nuclearization of Japan be punishment of China and North Korea, but it would go far to meet our goal of dissuading Iran. It would show Tehran that the United States and its friends will aggressively seek to correct any attempt by rogue states to unsettle any regional nuclear balance. Now, you and I were talking about this earlier today. You said the U.S., the U.K., and Israel are the only, members of this particular nuclear club. India, you put India in there.
No,
was something that I didn't understand.
Yeah, well, let me just step back a bit and correct one thing you said that's from our conversation, and we're going to be addressing it today on my show. We're having a mini cabinet of these people. The theory... what you called the conspiracy, well, not the conspiracy theory, there's a theory called proxy nuclear states that was put forward by Professor Madhav Nalapat, who is the man who organized both the first India-China conference in 2000 and organized the India-Israel-U.S. trilateral conference in New Delhi in 2003 and the second one held in Israel a year later. Now, what... Professor Nalapat, who teaches at the India's elite Manipal Academy of Higher Education and holds a UNESCO Peace Chair, what he posits is the following. He says China has been playing behind the scenes for years, building up Pakistan's nuclear capability and North Korea's in order to challenge the two great democracies in Asia, India and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And now that China, despite its diplomatic niceties of words at the UN, is actually encouraging North Korea to saber rattle, to knock the Americans off balance because they're so heavily committed in the Middle East. And perhaps no one knows more about what's going on in there than Nalapat, because India, you have to remember there's two things happening. There's the nuclear problem in the Far East, the Islamo fascist problem in the Mid East, and in the middle you've got the world's biggest democracy, India, that's already been at war with China, as you know, in the 50s and 60s, and they're caught in the middle. Almost a billion people. As a matter of fact, demographers say that within 10 years, India will exceed China in population. So this is a critical decision to make. And what David was saying in his article, and what Professor Nalapat will be discussing with us tonight, is that if China wants to upset the balance by creating not only a nuclear Pakistan, which we've already seen is not a proper ally of the West, they'll destabilize by creating a nuclear North Korea, no matter how small the nuclear weapons. The only counter to that would then be a nuclear Japan.
There's a new militaristic, Western-friendly Prime Minister of Japan,
yes,
who would
Abe.
Be amenable to that.
That's correct. And why is that important for the biggest democracy in the world? Because it's got a new nuclear ally in Japan. So you've got even American nuclear missiles in Japan. India's a nuclear power long past. Okay. Let's, you know, and you've got a party. Let's go, boys. Let's see who blinks first. And Chris is signaling again.
We're out of here.
We're out of here.
Thanks very much, Beryl. The other side of 7 o'clock news. Beryl Wiseman, the last angry man. Well, that's all we got for the Drive with Duff on this Wednesday evening. Thank you very much, to Chris Bumbry and Master Control and to Melissa Wheeler and Margo Edwards for, putting the guests together and getting it all sorted up. And, thank you for listening. Listen, you got any comments? Drive with Duff at 940montreal.com. Love to hear from you. Go to my blog site on the new 940 website, and your comments, always welcome. I'll share them with everyone on the air. See you tomorrow.
What if there was a war going on, and it was so unconventional that it made the war against the Islamofascists, the non-uniformed homicide bombers, look like the most obvious thing in the world? We may have two parallel crises going on in this small planet tumbling through space. The Middle East one has repercussions, reverberations, resonations of World War II, genocidal intentions, an enemy that wants territorial aggression, imposition of a tyranny, religious rather than political. Clearly, this enemy can't be identified with uniforms and tanks. But it's there. The outlines, the parameters are there. But in the Far East, the nuclear crisis sparked by North Korea brings out an image of a different kind of war. Not World War II, but World War I. Things happening in the background, countries getting involved in conflicts, and then in the inimitable scene that Barbara Tuchman painted in The Guns of August, people standing around saying, how did we get into this? A lot of people this week have been speculating, is North Korea crazy? Do they really have a bomb? Maybe it wasn't a bomb. Why are they doing this? Well, one man who has an idea of what's going on and how to stop getting from here to there without asking how did we get here is Madhav Dasnalapat. Professor Nalapat is director of the School of Geopolitics at the elite Manipal Academy in New Delhi. He played a critical role in the recent U.S.-India nuclear agreements, is consulted by many governments and security strategies. Amazingly, he's been both the organizer of the 2000 India-China conference and the 2003 and 2004 trilateral India-Israel-U.S. conferences, one which took place in India, one which took place in Israel. And he put forward a theory in 1998 called the proxy state theory, the proxy nuclear state theory, that China, despite whatever protestations of diplomatic niceties it wants to make at the UN, encouraged Pakistan to become a nuclear power in order to tip the balance and keep the democracies of India and Japan in Asia off balance. And that now it has encouraged North Korea to do the same, but this time challenging America. Because between these two great centers of crises, in the Middle East and the Far East, stands the world's largest democracy, which is India. And many demographers think that by the year 2010 will actually exceed China in population. Perhaps no other country on earth stands at such a crossroads and has so much riding on the outcome, and yet so much to teach us. And we're very privileged to have Professor Madhav Dasnalapat with us from Bangalore. Professor Nalapat, thanks for getting up this early. It's, what is it, 4:30 your time, 4 o'clock?
Well, yes, it's about that time, yes.
Professor, could you talk to us about your theory of proxy nuclear states and tell me where I've presented it properly or improperly in my introduction?
Well, Beryl, the fact is that, you know, we had this conventional theory of nuclear deterrence, that if one state attacks another with nuclear weapons, then that state can respond back with nuclear weapons, and therefore that the state will hesitate to attack another. Now, what happened...
That was the traditional mutual assured destruction theory when there were two superpowers.
Absolutely.
The United States and the Soviet Union.
That's correct. Now, what happens if a state deliberately creates a nuclear state, which is not itself, which is much smaller than itself, and over which it has, for example, some degree of political influence or whatever. Now, supposing that proxy nuclear state proxy because it's not a natural nuclear state. It doesn't have either the intellectual or the industrial infrastructure to build nuclear weapons and delivery systems, but it's gifted them by this power. Now, this power creates a proxy power, and the proxy power attacks you. Now, you destroy the proxy power, or you attack the proxy power, but the real culprit escapes completely. So this is one way in which a nuclear state can devastate another nuclear state by creating a proxy state that can hit this nuclear state. So this is why a new threat has come into the world horizon. And these states, the two states I mentioned in 1998, were exactly North Korea and Pakistan, two states that were artificially made nuclear powers by China, one to contain India and the other to contain Japan and now the United States.
Now, when you talk about proxy states, we're going to take a short break to pay some bills. I want to ask you about the non-developed status of the states at the time when the money started to flow and the big power of China tried to build them up, because both Pakistan then and North Korea now are truly failed states. We'll be right back with Professor Madhav Nalapat on the crisis in North Korea. And if the crisis in North Korea makes you nervous, we want to hear from you. Call in or email us at info@iapm.ca. We want to hear from you tonight, and it's our privilege to have with us Professor Madhav Nalapat, Director of the School of Geopolitics at the Manipal Academy in New Delhi. He's joining us from Bangalore tonight and got up real early to do this, and we're talking about his theory of the proxy nuclear states. Professor Nalapat, a proxy state, Pakistan at the time it started its nuclear development, at the time it achieved its nuclear development, was borderline failed state. North Korea is a failed state. Is that one of the prerequisites that you're just so down that you're going to go for any degree of power that anybody hands you, like China?
Well, they are failed states in one sense. Pakistan is a crucible of jihad, and North Korea is one of the most horribly repressive countries in the world. But the ruling structures are immensely successful in both these places. In Pakistan, the military has virtual control over the government in Pakistan, despite the fact that every democracy in the world, including, unfortunately, India, is now pandering to the military dictator in Pakistan. In the case of North Korea, you have a dictator and who's almost psychotic. And this man has total control over a country that is starving, that is brutalized, and yet which follows them because of lack of information about the outside world. So the sad truth is that neither is a failed state from the point of view of those who are ruling those states. And this is a prerequisite for being a proxy nuclear power. You need a very strong structure that has total control over the state and that can do the bidding of the power that makes you into a proxy nuclear state.
Now, in your comments in our first segment, you painted a picture of proxy states acquiring either nuclear weapons or at least dirty bombs. Are we going into a period of history where we're going to see smaller states, as you pointed out, attacking each other, but at one point getting middle or large powers involved through treaty obligations, and the bombs are just going to start flying, not between the great powers, but the great powers being sucked in through the little nations?
Well, Beryl, the sad truth is that Pakistan today is in a position to devastate a substantial part of India. And North Korea, with a little more effort, can devastate Japan. And if these two countries are devastated, then I think it has an impact on the United States and the rest of the world.
Now, let's
in a very, very short while, the North Koreans will be able to devastate, even the west coast of the United States. So it's not simply India and Japan, but it could be later on Europe as well. Pakistan, for example, is developing missiles with the help of North Korea, with the help of China, that can reach Europe. So it's a large number of countries are going to be in the grip of this kind of fear.
Now, let's paint an even more stark picture for our audience. And you mentioned Pakistan and missiles, and this is important. We know that Iranian observers, Iranian military officials, Iranian nuclear officials have been present at the North Korean tests, even the failed ones of several weeks ago, and at the rocket tests. We know that Iran has the rocket capability to deliver a nuclear bomb. 47 of their installations, the Zalzil rockets, were destroyed in the war against Hezbollah by Israel. How dangerous are Iran's ties with North Korea and this axis with Pakistan that even America is now questioning its worth as an ally?
Well, Iran has also got a ruling structure that is extremely dysfunctional from the point of view of the modern world. Now, they have a band of mullahs out there who have almost total control of the economy and, frighteningly, total control of tens and tens and billions of oil money. So, yes, Iran is a future potential proxy nuclear state if the major nuclear state, that is China, decides that if Iran can be given nuclear weapons and therefore be, in a sense, immune from counteraction by the United States. In that case, the odds are very high that Iran is going to follow Pakistan and North Korea and be armed with nuclear weapons. The reality is that China will do almost anything to checkmate the United States. And if that includes the provisioning of countries with nuclear weapons, with missile technology, then so be it. They've done it in Korea. They've done it in Pakistan.
And they're not even shy about it. When China Minmetals, which is a Chinese state corporation that reports to the Central Committee of the Communist Party, was trying to buy Inco and Falconbridge, two of Canada's biggest resource companies, China openly said, we want the resources for our expanding military ambitions. And many people just refuse to believe it. Many people here. What is this problem that Westerners have believing that China has ambitions, aggressive ambitions?
You know, Beryl, I think the major problem that people in the West have is that they don't understand the chemistry, the mental chemistry of what goes on in other societies. Now, we are seeing that same problem in the Middle East, for example, where the United States is not able to understand the mental chemistry of the Iraqi people and, in fact, the broader people of that area, and as a result is making some horrible psychological errors in the war against terror there. Now, the same thing is happening in the case of China. Now, the United States today in a situation where it relies on Pakistan to fight Al-Qaeda, when it is the Pakistan army that has actually created the Taliban, the Pakistan army that is finding the Taliban extremely useful in its narcotics and other joint activities.
And has protected the Taliban from the Canadian-led Operation Medusa into its own territory.
And then the case of North Korea, the United States is now going hat in hand to China, the very country that has made North Korea a nuclear power, and frankly the country that in 24 hours can bring North Korea to its knees. If North Korea is standing today and threatening the world, it's entirely because China does not want any situation that's different.
Now, that brings forth the final question. If China has now pushed its proxy North Korea to tip the balance, is the proper Western response to put nuclear weapons into Japan, as has been suggested in North American press today?
Well, the proper response would be to develop a very strong shield against a nuclear attack by a proxy state. Fortunately, a proxy state has got certain limitations. It is not as powerful as a major nuclear state. And it is possible, I think, not only theoretically, but practically as well, to create a defense shield against that. So I think the emergence of North Korea, the emergence of Pakistan, and the possible emergence, sadly, of Iran in the future means that it's very important to go in for an anti-missile shield. That's the first point. And the second point is that the country that has made these countries nuclear weapons powers and missile powers should be made to pay a huge part of the cost. There's no point targeting North Korea. The problem with North Korea is the same problem with Iraq and Saddam Hussein. I used to point out that sanctions in Iraq were useless because Saddam Hussein doesn't care if every other Iraqi falls dead of starvation. Kim Jong-il doesn't give a damn whether if every North Korean dies of starvation. The Pakistani generals don't give a damn so long as they're swimming in narco money. So you can't have sanctions that target the people. You have to have sanctions that target the people and the country that's behind this proliferation. And the country that's behind this proliferation is China. So if the United States regards China as a solution and gives benefits to China, rather than targets China and sanctions China, I'm afraid this problem is going to go completely out of control. Beryl, I feel we are like the Rhineland situation in 1935. North Korea, in a sense, has crossed the Rhineland. Now, if the entire world just sits back as they sat back when they allowed Hitler to cross the Rhineland, then we are going to see 1939, 1940 in very, very soon.
Indeed. Professor Madhav Nalapat, many thanks for joining us so early, your time, and many thanks for your words of wisdom. And we'll continue to get them out there, and people will listen.
Thank you, Bert.
Thank you, madam. Montreal, we'll be right back. Tonight is ground zero in the North Korea crisis, and I got to say that our guests tonight are cabinet. Any head of government would be very wise to listen to the guests we have tonight. Our lines are getting lit up. I would ask our callers to be patient as we're joined by General Lewis McKenzie. Lou, welcome. Thank you for taking time out tonight.
My pleasure, Barrow.
And this is going to be one conversation with Lewis McKenzie that will not center on tactics and the Middle East. Because Lewis McKenzie, for my money, has the best strategic mind out there. And we hope that a lot of people and a lot of opinion makers, I'm going to be joined later by Frank Gaffney Jr. from Washington, are going to be listening to what Lewis McKenzie has to say. Lou, Madhav Nalapat, who knows this problem probably better than any person at the crossroads of the Mideast and the Far East. He's been in China. He organized the first India-China conference. He organized the first India-Israel-U.S. trilateral conferences on nuclear energy, on nuclear weapons. He made the critical role in the U.S.-India nuclear agreements. He says that, forget about sanctions against Korea, forget about putting missiles into Japan. As much as China has pushed Korea and Pakistan as being what he calls proxy nuclear states, what America's got to do now is stop feeding China. How do we get that accomplished, particularly in a country like Canada that thinks, at least before the Harper government, that thinks that China is God's gift to humanity? And do you agree with him?
Well, yeah, I certainly take his words seriously, and as a result, I guess that's an acknowledgement that I certainly agree with the thesis. One of the great problems is, and you know this as well as better than most, Darrell, and that is complacency, and you're dealing with the West that wants to see everybody as being touchy-feely and good and driven by the economics of the situation, and China being just the greatest potential customer in the world for the rest of us. You know, we don't want to upset them too much, and they're really handling us very well with velvet gloves when it comes to the economy. I mean, unlike Russia, where they used to seize any sort of capitalist that went in there to set up a business. I mean, that's not happening in China. Western companies are being very well received. But at the same time, you have to be concerned because while they might not have any colonial sort of ambitions, they're big enough that their mere presence and operating proxies certainly gives them the potential to eclipse the United States.
That's what Nalapat had to say, that with one finger they could tip over everything. And what he said was, and I want to know what you think of this both as a strategist and as a military man, what he said was that the defense shield concept, even the anti-missile shield concept, has got to be rethought. We're not talking about defense shields and anti-missile shields in terms of weaponry. We're talking about it in terms of policies that don't hurt the people of Pakistan and North Korea as much as restrain and cut off the blood supply to its client, to its main mother state, which is China.
Yeah, and I don't think the West is, I mean, we have to be realistic here. I don't think the West, in spite of the fact there might be those in policy positions that agree with that, I don't think the West is going to do anything about it. Not anything up front, anyway. There's a lot of appeasement going on these days in the interests of the economy. The eye is focused on a relatively minor threat, but it's one that captures the headlines every day, and that's the sort of transnational terrorism, as opposed to local terrorism like you find in Palestine, for example, Israel-Palestine crisis,
right. Or
even in Afghanistan. I mean, there's not a lot of transnational terrorism going on. So we've been fairly successful in drying up the cash and eliminating the head of the snake and getting at the leaders, etc. So it's not a big threat to us. Even, God forbid, that they get one small yield nuclear weapon. It's still, as sort of in the overall context, it's not a massive threat.
Lou, they're making signals at me. We ought to take a break. Can you stay with us through the break?
Yeah, sure.
Thanks, Lou. We'll be right back with General Lewis McKenzie. Well, this is Ground Zero tonight to discuss the North Korean crisis. And if you had concerns before after listening to Professor Madhav Nalapat from India, your concern should be severely heightened. And we've been talking with General Lewis McKenzie, and we're glad that that General McKenzie can spend some time with us tonight. Lou, you said before the break that What is too obvious to you, to me, and to like-minded individuals, that there's no political will in the West to stop feeding the Chinese tiger because of the potential for money. So does that leave the only option, this missiles in Japan idea that's been floated around North America today, to offset what Nalapat called the proxy state of North Korea?
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's spy versus spy, and up the ante and move and counter move type of thing. I'm of the age, fortunately, that I can still remember back to what my university professors were telling me many, many, many years ago. And one of the points that maybe is germane here, or at least relevant, is the fact that throughout history, a three-way balance of power hasn't necessarily been a bad thing. And certainly during the Cold War, the world was a lot more stable place. Now, the implication of failure was horrendous, thermonuclear exchange. But nevertheless, ever since we've had a one superpower world, we've had a fair amount of chaos with the proxies of, in the old days, of the Soviet Union and NATO, were kept in check. Well, they're not kept in check now.
They're not.
Sort of bursting out all over. So, providing thing is handled properly, and I don't know what properly means, but surely brains better than mine can figure out from a geopolitical point of view that the way they handle China and use China, and we've got a strong European Union, we've got Russia trying to get back in the superpower game, and obviously the United States, I mean, might not, now I underline, might not be a bad thing. The point is not to get carried away, I don't think, and immediately take something we knew was happening in North Korea anyway and turn it into another major crisis. And quite frankly, it would appear that the current administration in the U.S. isn't very good at handling more than one crisis at a time, and they got more than enough on their plate right now. So I'd tippy-toe around this for a while if I was in their position.
Yeah, they could have been counting on this. Tell me, strategically, militarily, policy perspective, there's been some talk out of Washington, some chatter about blockades and this kind of stuff. Can this really work? I mean, this isn't Cuba.
Yeah, and it's what they want. I mean, it'll keep them on the front page of Time to be sarcastic about it. I mean,
no, but physically, can it work? I mean, when I say it isn't Cuba, there is more than one way in, and the coastlines are awfully long.
Yeah, and if you're going to involve the people in the neighborhood, that's courting disaster. If you're going to ask Japan to assist you, for example, or in South Korea, then that's not very smart. So you can do a token. You can't do a Falklands and you can't do a Cuba, but you can certainly, with the detection these days with GPS and satellite imagery and all that, you can detect where the target is, or at least where the ship is that you're suspicious of, and move in very quickly and do that. I'm not sure that that's a wise thing. Much better to blockade people as they're leaving some port with produce for China and stop them from going in rather than stopping goods from China coming out.
What about the blockade they're talking about of Korea, of North Korea?
Yeah, I don't know how you beat up on Korea anymore, quite frankly. I mean, you talk about a basket case. I mean, for God's sake, anything we do there, just feeds to the popularity of someone who's defying the West, and George Bush in particular. So I'm not sure that you can beat up on the people of Korea much, although I must admit the first rung of ladder of escalation in punishing a nation, it's always been sanctions. I've been in three countries where sanctions have been imposed, and all I saw were the poorest of the poor and the absolute bottom of society. They were the ones that were suffering. The other guys at the top are doing just fine, thank you very much.
Sad truth of our world. Lewis McKenzie, thanks very, very much for being with us today and sharing your wisdom.
Pleasure, bro.
Take
care. Have a good one.
We will. Montreal, we'll be right back. Well, we're talking about North Korea tonight, and this is ground zero, and our guests, as I said, would constitute a cabinet for any head of government. Madhav Nalapat was with us earlier there at the center of the storm in India, between the right of the crossroads, the nuclear crisis in the Far East, the Islamo-fascist crisis in the Middle East. We heard from Lewis McKenzie, and I think now we're going to hear from where it really counts, one of the best-informed, most experienced minds inside the Beltway from Washington. Frank Gaffney Jr. is president of the Center for Security Policy. He's held senior positions in the Department of Defense under President Ronald Reagan, including that of Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy. And he's the lead author of War Footing, 10 Steps America Must Take to Prevail in the War for the Free World. I recommend this book. It's got tremendous contributors, and several of the authors and the people who wrote some of the prefaces and prologues have been on this show, like James Woolsey and Victor Davis Hanson. Frank Gaffney, thank you for joining us. Welcome.
It's a great pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Frank, we've heard from A to Z tonight. Madhav Nalapat is telling us that Korea, proxy state like Pakistan, pushed by China. They wanted to push the democracies of Japan and India. Now they're pushing North Korea to put it to the states and see how the states react. He's talking about forgetting about everything except cutting off the supply of money to China and trade. That is the defense shield, the anti-missile shield. Lewis McKenzie, who has 30 years of experience in international peacemaking efforts, and certainly no wallflower or wilting flower, would love a more aggressive policy on the part of the Western world. He, I think, feels that the West hasn't got the will, and almost hopes that this is a tempest in a teapot in North Korea. Frank Gaffney, the next move is yours. What say you? And are the missiles in Japan an option?
Well, I suspect that there will be missiles in Japan in due course, as I think the Japanese perceive what's happening in North Korea as a material and perhaps even existential threat to the home island of Japan. I would not be surprised at all to see Japan exercising an option it's long had to go nuclear. And it would accompany those nuclear weapons, of course, with delivery systems capable of reaching North Korea. What's happening here is, I think, the predictable consequence of the cumulative failure of Western efforts, mostly diplomatic, over the past 12 years or so, to address the underlying reality of what's going on, namely that Communist China has seen it to be very expedient and, I think, strategically valuable to promote a state that is the bad boy in the neighborhood, if you will. They've enabled this regime to persist. I'm quite confident that they have provided them not only the food and the energy and money that is necessary to support such a an otherwise bankrupt and untenable operation to keep going, but also the nuclear technology, the nuclear weapons technology, either directly or through a proxy like Pakistan, if not directly from the Pakistani government, then through its cutout, AQ Khan, but probably all of the above. And that's the underlying reality. I think it is a reality that is not going to be ameliorated by more negotiations, more reliance on the Chinese to try to help us sort this out, and certainly not by the U.N.
The U.N. Diplomatic efforts have been just about useless, as Anne Baevsky of the Hudson Institute pointed out here generally, and there's generally too much of a reliance. But this, you know, one thing, it's obvious that President Bush was right in his famous Axis of Evil speech. We're all seeing it now. But there's a horrible failure of political and national will in the West. And one writer in Canada said perhaps the only reason why we won't make a comparison to the 1938-39 period is that it seems at least that the English-speaking world in Israel are getting it, that Blair and Bush and John Howard of Australia and the New Zealand's Prime Minister and Harper of Canada are at least on the same page. How dangerous is it if one of the players falls off that cycle?
Well,
as we're going into the American elections?
I hope that they are, in fact, on the same page. I hope they are being as robust as you suggest. And it is certainly the case that there's going to be changes in that lineup before too long. Now, with Tony Blair's retirement,
right,
with the elections coming up here in the United States Congress, that might well create very substantial new restraints on President Bush. But here's the larger point. All of them, as far as I know, persist in believing that diplomacy can work and must be exhausted before we do anything else.
But I wanted to ask you that. I actually wanted to lead with that, but we've had so much material. When we hear that Secretary Rice and the Chinese were talking, quote, all night, when we in Canada hear that our own foreign minister, Peter McKay, is talking to his Chinese counterpart, surely to God, I mean, these are smart people. They don't really believe the Chinese are going to lay all their cards on the table.
I think they believe that
Frank,
the Chinese,
tell me it ain't so, Frank.
I wish I could. I think they believe that the Chinese are on their team. And it's
when
just basically a question of working out some of the fine points, the details, and China will do the deal for us.
I know that
Could I just mention the four things that I think argue against relying on diplomacy in general and negotiations specifically with a country like or a government like that of Kim Jong-il? One, it legitimates that government when we should be doing exactly the opposite. We should be doing everything possible to delegitimate it. It shouldn't be hard to do. It is, after all, a government that has killed 2 million of its own people through starvation and brutalized the rest of them. We should not be emboldening that government, which we are doing by treating with them, a sign of contemptible weakness, as they see it. We should not be buying them time, which we have done for the past 12 years and are continuing to do by negotiating with them. And certainly, we should not be kidding ourselves that we're actually doing something material about the problem when we are in the act of negotiating, and by so doing, prevent ourselves from taking other steps that are more sensible, more practical, and certainly more necessary if we seek to actually contain and hopefully roll back this threat.
Frank Gaffney, please stay with us. I got to do one short practical break to pay some bills. We'll be right back with you.
All right.
Zero on the North Korea crisis tonight. And we're continuing our conversation with Frank Gaffney, Jr., President of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, former Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Reagan. I would recommend the website. There's incredible material there, centerforsecuritypolicy.org. Frank, you gave us 4 points. The problems with negotiating with countries like North Korea, rogue states, you give them legitimacy when you negotiate. Number two, don't embolden them. Number three, don't buy them time. And number four, if you're a Western power, don't pretend to be doing something when you're not. Now, one of the things you've recommended, there's a tremendous op-ed by Frank in today's Globe and Mail, dealing decisively with the enemies. You suggest a ramp-up of the U.S. effort to deploy this effective anti-missile defense first sought by President Reagan. Could you describe what kind of anti-missile defense that would be?
We have begun deploying, as you know, a modest defense in Alaska and California, a defense that might be adequate to deal with some aspects of a fairly modest North Korean ballistic missile program. What we need to do, though, if we're serious about providing protection not only to our own territory here in the United States, but also to our friends and our forces closer to the North Korean launching areas, is to put missile defenses at sea aboard ships we've already bought and paid for. They're called ships with the Aegis Fleet Air Defense System on them. We have about 80 of them in the United States Navy today, and they represent an incredible capability if it's optimized for this purpose, a relatively inexpensive, relatively near-term way to provide the kind of protection against the worst sorts of threats that the North Koreans represent.
Would this kind of ratcheting up of missile budgets also have another political effect? Going back to the late 70s and into the Reagan era, three things happened that contributed greatly to bring an end to the Soviet Union. Jackson-Vanik Amendment cut off most favored nation status. Helsinki Final Act got the Europeans on board, but it really wasn't until President Reagan ratcheted up the arms race, the defense budgets. The Soviet Union just couldn't keep up. Could that kind of a ratcheting up of military budget material and capability bring even the mother state of these proxies, as Professor Nalapat would put it, to some kind of a different realization of where it's going geopolitically?
By that, you mean China?
Yes.
I think a strategy that takes pretty much those items out of the Reagan playbook can have a very pronounced effect, not only with respect to North Korea, but also with communist China. We can create some costs to China for playing the double game that it has been playing for all these many years. The specific things which I would adapt for this purpose are cut off the cash flow to the regime in North Korea by denying it the financial institution support that it's been getting. We've already started doing that by encouraging Americans, and for that matter Canadians and other freedom-loving people, to stop investing in companies that do business with North Korea, Chinese and others. And one of the things Reagan did, you may remember, was part of sort of the general strategy of which Jackson Vanik was actually an early precursor.
Yep.
Was to go after the Siberian gas pipeline and say to companies that were talking with the Russians about building it, you can do business with them or you can do business with us. And when Margaret Thatcher pleaded with him, he said, no, we're going to impose import controls on these companies. Were we to do that to the Chinese communist enterprises that are helping to support the regime in Pyongyang?
Directly support.
Or those of South Korea. I think you would have a very pronounced effect.
Absolutely. This is one of the most remarkable things. When China Minmetals, which is controlled, of course, by the Central Committee of the Communist Party, came into Canada and tried to buy Inco and Falconbridge, and a great many of us in social action were against this because China said openly, we want the resources to increase our military. And, right. Of course, the progressives refuse to believe it. The progressives always refuse to believe what the dictators say. They ratchet it down, and they always condemn what leaders of the free world say. Frank Gaffney, we thank you very much for being with us, and I think you're getting a message across to us, and we've been hearing it all night. Just to quote the French philosopher Alain Finkielkraut, barbarism is not the prehistory of humanity, but sadly sometimes the faithful shadow that accompanies its every step. But as long as we have voices like yours, that shadow will be kept at bay. Thank you, Frank Gaffney. Thank you, all our other guests. Nick Mays in Master Control. Montreal, we'll be back with you tomorrow night.